We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and I'm glad to have you with us. The guest for the first hour of the show today is Carlos Eyre. He is a professor of history and religious studies at Yale University. And in his new book, he writes that he has long puzzled over death. In fact, he says for more than three decades, this question has informed his scholarly work. So perhaps it's no surprise that he should also be interested in death's opposite, that is, eternity, a concept that he says is an essential component of the history of Western civilization. That is the subject of his new book, the subject of our conversation this morning. The book is entitled A Very Brief History of Eternity. The book is published by the Princeton University Press and is just recently out. It explores this concept, looks at its many forms, at least the forms that it has taken in the Western world and in Western thought, beginning with the Greeks and coming to our present day, and also looks at the way that the notion of our notions of eternity has helped to shape our collective self-understanding. Our guest, Carlos Eyre, is the author of the memoir Waiting for Snow in Havana, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2003. He's also written a number of works of religious history, and he's joining us this morning from Yale. Professor Eyre, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Well, thanks for inviting me to be on your show. Pleasure.
Let me also mention that comments and questions from listeners are welcome here. People can call, as usual, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you may email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Either way, comments are welcome, but please, please do keep them brief. Maybe the place to start is where you start. With the idea that everything ends. And I suppose that that really is the root of our idea of eternity, or maybe the desire for eternity, the fact that we know, as much as we might not like to think about it, we know that things will end.
Yeah, I think on a personal and collective level, we all know things will end. As we see our loved ones depart, as we contemplate our own end. But also now, as scientists have pointed out to us, it's not just beings on Earth, all beings, but the universe itself that will come to an end, but then perhaps also begin again. So we've sort of come full circle in the late 20th, early 21st century, in that now many of our scientists are dealing with eternity as a very real thing. But collectively, as a society, we in the West no longer live or act collectively as if eternity exists.
You know, I think right there, that's a couple of things you said are very interesting. And one, the thing that I grabbed onto first was this notion that astrophysicists, people like that, people who think about the universe and where it came from and where it's going, that they should actually embrace a concept like eternity, which we would think would be the province of theologians. And yet, as you say, it's true that, and again, it makes it a little frustrating sometimes because if you ask astrophysicists, well, how did the universe begin? And they'd say, well, we're not really sure. And you say, when? Well, we're not really sure. When's it going to end? Well, we're not really sure.
Well,
what happens after the end? Well, we're not really sure.
No. I found out the hard way when my manuscript was sent to an astrophysicist at Princeton and he read it. And he said I ascribed too much certainty to science. So I had to clear that up.
So indeed, even on the scientific side, they're trying to puzzle out the same notions. And they do, in fact, have this idea that, well, whenever the universe as we know it comes to an end, that doesn't necessarily mean that will be the end full stop. They say, well, you know, maybe there would be – so maybe there was one Big Bang and its consequences will be followed through. And then at some point they say, well, maybe there'll be another Big Bang and the whole thing will start all over again.
I refer to that as the big yo-yo in my book. It's the idea that there's a Big Bang and then a big crunch and a Big Bang and a big crunch eternally. Or the idea that there are multiple universes. And that perhaps one of the wildest ideas is that perhaps in another universe there are other copies of us.
Mm-hmm.
I can't even really call them copies, but you know our life is being lived out eternally in different dimensions. That's as close as I have seen scientists come to seriously considering the eternity of human selves or human beings. Normally, we're left out of the picture because we're just collections of atoms and neurons, and we come and go like everything else in the material universe.
Huh. One reason, obviously, that we're so uncomfortable with the idea that things end is that we're not comfortable with the idea of us personally ending.
Right.
Of the fact that we will die, that our lives will come to the end, that we will lose whatever pleasure in life we have, that we'll no longer see our parents, our children, our friends, all of that. So partly our resistance is not wanting to let go. But it does seem to be the case, and there's science actually to back this up, that we just – that the concept of nothing, of everything ending – is something that we're just not wired up to be able to accept.
That's right. And you know, some have gone as far as to say that to think of nothing as a something is what the best we can do. We cannot think of nothing. It's impossible. We're not wired to handle that. Perhaps as a survival mechanism, some Darwinians might say it's a way of keeping us from eating our own children.
Mm. Why, just to jump right up to where we are now here, we can talk about how we got to where we are now, but I think you make this interesting point that while it is that many people as individuals will still say that they believe in, to the extent that they can wrap their brains around it, the idea of eternity. But that as a society, it's not something that we really talk about anymore. Why is it that on the one hand, on an individual level, we're still holding on to it, but that on this other level, we don't?
Well, I think it's because in most cases, belief in eternal life for individuals has a religious dimension to it. And in Western societies, since the 18th century, ever increasingly, religion has moved to the private sphere and has been removed from the public sphere. As we've seen lately with several cases, the moment one brings religion into public discourse, many object. So this is why the latest Pew poll revealed that something close to 80% of Americans who were polled by the Pew Foundation believe in eternal life in some way. That's a very high percentage. In Europe, the figures are lower, but it's very private. But, of course, it ceases to be private once you get into a faith community of some sort that shares in this view. Then there, within that building or that space, everyone sort of shares the belief. But once they step out the front door or the back door, the belief goes straight inside their heads and hearts.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Carlos Eyre. He is a Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University, and he is the author of a recently published book, A Very Brief History of Eternity, and is published by the Princeton University Press. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, or by email, will-talk at illinois.edu. I understand, I heard an interview where you said that what you wanted to title the book A Brusque History of Eternity, and the publisher said, we don't like the sound of that very much. What exactly is the difference between what were you trying to get across with that?
Well, I was trying to play on the contrast between eternity, which is, of course, immense beyond description, and any attempt to deal with it is, of course, brief. And I thought, what is briefer than brief? And I thought, okay. Brusque. And actually, when I gave lectures at Princeton on this subject, that was the title of the lecture. But the editors at Princeton thought that brusque had a sort of level of impoliteness to it that might put readers off. So I thought of how about a very, very brief? But apparently there are page guidelines, number of pages that you can have before you can call anything brief, very brief, or very, very brief. And I exceeded the page limit for very, very brief.
Someone has actually set a number to that?
Yes, apparently. You know, you have to be careful how you label your products, and you don't want to mislead your readers.
It's well, fortunately,
how brief something is.
We wouldn't have had a time for an unabridged history of eternity. So I guess you have to put some limits on it. Well, I have a caller here to bring into the conversation somebody who is calling from Terre Haute in Indiana. Let's do that on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. My question is, what is the position of the scientists as far as reincarnation? And I will hear the answer offline, please.
All right. I don't. Is that? Do you have an answer for that question?
I have not seen anything that links science or scientific research to reincarnation, except for I know that for many, many years, and perhaps it's still going on. There was a team of psychologists at the University of Virginia who were taking down life narratives from children. These are children under the age of 13 who claimed to remember previous lives. Many of these children were from cultures in which reincarnation is part of common belief, religious belief. Many of them were from India. I don't know what has come of that. That was a very sort of isolated lab there at the University of Virginia. In my research on eternity and eternal life, I didn't run into any sort of scientific literature on this subject.
Well, it's not something I don't really think that it's something that you – and maybe it was mentioned again, as I did at the beginning, is for the purposes of this book and our conversation, what you're doing is concentrating on the idea of eternity as it's been developed in Western thought, beginning with the ancient Greeks and through the – medieval Christian church and up to where we are now. So anybody else's other cultures, other philosophical traditions, ideas, that's somebody else's book. And now having said that, though, have you thought about, say the major differences between the way that people in the West have thought about the idea of eternity and people in the East thought about it?
Yes, I have. And one of the things that I think stands out is the big difference of, you know, one lifetime on Earth. Mm. This became the Christian and Western understanding of the individual. There was an early Christian thinker, Origen, 3rd century, who actually believed in transmigration of souls, reincarnation, and so on. And he was part of an early Christian community that actually believed in this, but those beliefs were rejected very early on. The individual in the West, having only one life, I think has this belief in one life on Earth, the individual, has led in the West to the creation of a higher sense of the individual. And by higher, I mean that there's a certain almost sacred quality to every human being, precisely because there's this. This is just the beginning here, but every single human being is eternal as a self. You know, reincarnation involves being many other selves. The Western notion is you always are just this one person. Mm.
We have another caller here to talk with. Let's do that in Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. May I present a view of eternity which proves that an eternal God must exist? And this view began when Einstein and Hubble proved that the universe had a beginning. In other words, the universe was not eternal. It had a beginning, and in fact, our scientific calculations tell us that nothing existed before the universe. Nothing material existed before the universe. Now we know that everything must have a cause. Everything must have a sufficient cause. And before the universe, there was nothing material. Now there is a universe. There must be something, someone, that is eternal, who can be a sufficient cause for the whole universe, and by the way, for the exquisite precision of that universe.
Professor Ayer?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'd have to say, you know, of course, this is one of Thomas Aquinas' famous five proofs for the existence of God. Of course, he didn't have Einstein and Hubble to cite. He certainly would have. You know, if he were living in the 20th century, he certainly would have, because he cited every authority he could, Christian or non-Christian. So this is an ancient argument which still, you know, stands exactly where it did 5-6 centuries ago.
Did the caller want to follow up?
That's sufficient. That's sufficient cause. Nice program, David.
All right. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Let us go back to the beginning of the thinking about eternity. And I'm interested in starting when talking, having you talk a little bit about the Greeks and how that goes from there to early Christianity, because it seems that the Greeks indeed had this idea that there was a time in which we live, but that there was a reality that was outside of time. There was something else. I'm not exactly sure what that something else was. Maybe we could start there and then talk about how we get from there to the idea that the thing that exists outside of time is God.
Right. Well, the ancient Greek philosophers, going way back, I can't trace the entire line back to the beginning where these abstractions began to be discussed. But by the time that you get to Plato, by the time you get certainly to the 5th century, the 4th century, the 3rd century B.C., you have Greeks who are conceptualizing an existence above and beyond time. So in other words, what you end up with is a conception of time and motion as inferior states of being. It's inferior to that other higher level of existence where it just is. Right. So this is by the time you get to the 1st century B.C. and the 1st century A.D. especially, in the Hellenistic world, by Hellenistic I mean the eastern part of the Mediterranean that was greatly influenced by Greek culture, this Greek abstraction begins to affect Jewish thinking. And it is reflected very clearly in the earliest Christian documents, which, of course, spring from this Eastern Mediterranean Jewish context. So it's a marriage of Greek and Jewish conceptions that brings the linkage between the Greek eternity and the Hebrew or Jewish personal God. Hmm.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana, line one.
Hello.
Yes.
Did you get any help or suggestions from the mathematical concept of infinity, which is kind of paradoxical in some respects, putting a set in one-to-one correspondence with a subset of itself and things like that? But it's been very suggestive to some people. I'll hang up. Thanks.
No, I haven't. A few comments on this. In distinguishing eternity as a subject, since eternity applies to time and infinity normally applies to space, and this distinction is made by philosophers and theologians, I didn't deal with infinity. So, no, that didn't help me much. I did once have a conversation with an Italian mathematician at Princeton, at the Institute for Advanced Study, and it was a very interesting evening because he kept arguing that the concept of infinity was, this is his term, stupid. And I couldn't quite understand why he thought it was stupid. So I don't know how that would go. I didn't converse with any mathematicians this time when I was writing this book. I am a math phobic. And that also has something to do with it. I failed one math course in high school, and ever since I've been terrified of mathematics.
And that shows you where you'll end up as a professor of history.
That's right.
If you don't pay attention to your math. That or a talk show host, speaking for myself. Our guest for this hour of the show is Carlos Ayer. He is Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. And we are talking about some of what you'll find in his recent book, A Very Brief History of Eternity. It's published by the Princeton University Press. This is WYLL 580 AM, 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3. Urbana. This is Focus 580. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. And again, our guest in this hour, Carlos Ayer. He's professor of history, religious studies at Yale University. He's the author of the memoir Waiting for Snow in Havana, which won the National Book Award for Nonfiction in 2003. He was nice enough to spend some time talking with us about that on this program. And if you'd like to go back and listen to that interview, you can go to our web archive at will.illinois.edu. And this morning, we welcome your comments on his new book. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. You want to email in a comment or a question, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have another caller here, someone in Champaign, so we'll go there. Line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I wonder if I could run two by you. One is, I've always thought in human terms, the idea of religiously thinking of eternity by human beings which don't live but 100 years. Even half of eternity is a long time to be in hell or heaven, either one. You would probably get, it would sort of go beyond our capacity to experience as an individual, I would think. In any event, passing that one, Einstein supposedly traditionally always said, when confronted with the idea of quantum physics, God doesn't play dice. And I've always wondered what. Do you have any insights into what he might have meant by God, like a logos or a design scheme? Or I wonder if you have any thoughts on that. Thank you.
Well, go ahead.
Einstein was somewhat cagey when it came to that subject. He also described relativity in the following way to his secretary. He was getting a lot of questions about relativity, and he said to the secretary, anytime anybody calls, give them this answer, which was when you sit next to when you sit on a hot stove, 1 minute can seem like an eternity. When you sit next to a beautiful girl, it vanishes too quickly. He had this way of expressing things very beautifully and cryptically too. By God, I think what he meant was not that he definitely was not the Hebrew Jewish Christian Muslim God. It was whatever intelligence had designed all this. I think what he meant by this argument was that there's obviously, as a previous caller pointed out, design and intelligence. So I think that's where he was going with that. Mm-hmm. As to conceiving of eternity on a personal level, what the Western tradition, especially the Christian tradition, has always said is that it would be ridiculous to try to project from earthly time-bound existence what eternity might be like, because it is above and beyond time and change. So in other words, what all the Christian writers have said is that eternity is definitely real for us as individuals, but is also totally unimaginable. So there, once again, you know, the brain stops working. You cannot even begin to conceive what it would be like.
Well, how then, though, do you get from this very abstract notion, something that you almost can't grab onto, to the idea, though, that in one sense, as far as a lot of Christians are concerned, that eternity is actually a place?
Right. Well, there was a major change that took place in the 16th and 17th century. Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler realigned the cosmos. Up until the 17th century, the view that Westerners had of time and space was that, of course, there were, you know, seven concentric spheres. Earth was at the center, and up through the various levels of heaven, at the very highest level, the Empyrean heaven, where there was no motion. That was the eternal realm where God lived and where we would all end up. Once this map of the cosmos was erased by Copernicus and Galileo, Christians had to conceive of eternity and heaven not as something up there. This is the major change that takes place in the West. You used to be able to look up to heaven, and you'd say the Lord's Prayer, "Our Father who art in heaven, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven," was a place above us, way beyond. It stopped being that. It became simply a different dimension, which we have no clue exactly where that is. If you understand what I mean in terms of a location, it's not a location anymore after Copernicus and Galileo. Hell, well, that's a different thing. And, hell was imagined in innumerable ways. There are so many lengthy descriptions of what hell is like in Christian literature that it boggles the mind. But even though the place, hell, was described in great detail up until the 20th century, and I think in some circles it still continues to be described in great detail in some churches, the concept of, you know, being in that place forever, all the preachers and writers would say that is unimaginable, you know, eternal pain, eternal suffering. But it's linked in the West, in the Christian tradition. Eternity is intimately linked to the question of justice, because it's quite obvious that here on earth, many, many people do terrible things and live very comfortably, and they don't pay a price for their bad behavior. And similarly, many good people suffer greatly and do not receive any reward for their goodness. So in this way, heaven and hell are linked in the Christian tradition to the individual's behavior. Heaven, there are very, very few descriptions of heaven, comparatively speaking. You compare descriptions of hell and descriptions of heaven, much easier in the past for Christians to imagine hell than to imagine heaven. And also in descriptions of heaven, I've been told this since the book came out by quite a few people. Well, you know, heaven is boring. descriptions of heaven are awfully boring. What do you do up there? You know, this is hell is a lot more interesting. Well, there you have it. It's one of those peculiar features of human thought. Well, we can imagine the terrible much more easily than we can imagine the blissful.
Well, let's say in one sense, it seems curious in that being able to go to heaven is your reward for following the rules, and you would think that you would want to make that enticing, but perhaps it's also understandable that you would emphasize the punishment involved in not following the rules more than what it is, more than the positive reward that comes with going with the program.
Right, and the first Westerners in the 18th century to question the idea of the Christian hell and the Christian heaven. Among them, one that stands out is Voltaire. You know, when Voltaire said, if God did not exist, we would have to invent him, he wasn't just referring to the design in the universe. He was referring to the ethical dimension, because he also said that every magistrate, every ruler, every king, every prince needed hell in order to make people behave well. How do you get the citizens to behave if, in fact, there is no eternal consequence to their behavior? So he ended up saying that, you know, teaching and preaching hell is necessary, even if it really doesn't exist, just to get people to behave. And several of his friends and colleagues also worried about how it was that you could motivate people to be good without belief in hell. Of course, it was proven the succeeding two centuries that, in fact, yeah, many people can behave ethically without believing in an afterlife. And the latest campaign by the diehard atheists, both in Europe and here in the United States, who have put billboards up and placards on buses, I've seen one of them that basically it turns the argument around. It says, be good for goodness sake. You don't need a God to be good. You just be good for goodness sake. Voltaire had a little trouble with that as a pragmatic approach to governing. He thought it was impossible to get people to be good for goodness sakes.
Well, I have some callers here. Also, I want to get an email question here. A listener asks, what part of eternity lies outside of the human mind? That's the first part. The second part of his question, and what role did Kierkegaard and his philosophy play in our understanding of eternity?
The first question, I'm not quite sure I understand fully. I'll take a stab. What part of eternity is outside of our mind? Well, I would think that, you know, that every throughout the 2,000 years of Christian history, there would have been different answers to that question. Right. But basically, eternity is above and beyond material existence. That's the Christian idea. Yes, this is time and space related. Our minds are in the here and now. Eternity is not. But our mind is able to conceive of it. I mean, we do conceive of the idea. It's very possible. It's very easy. It's like conceiving of a circle or a square. That part is within our mind, the conception of it. But experiencing it, that's what's outside the mind. As to Kierkegaard, well, you know, in the 19th and 20th century, you know, Kierkegaard had his profound influence on believers, especially Protestant Christians. And he's part of the continuity in Christian thought that, in fact, you know, and Kierkegaard having influenced the 20th century existentialists. I mean, a basic part of the premise is, look at how miserable this existence is, how limited, how painful, what a situation we find ourselves in, aware of our mortality, aware of our moral failures, aware of our limitations. Without eternity on the horizon, life here is truly unbearable. And this is the view that many believers still have, that in fact, having no eternal horizon, the temporal becomes unbearable. However, since my book has come out, several book reviewers and people who have emailed me and people I've spoken with have told me that they are very, very supremely comfortable with the idea of their own mortality, and that thinking of eternity disgusts them. Hmm. So again, this is the funny thing about belief, you know. Everyone responds and reacts to propositions differently.
Our guest in this hour, Carlos Ayer, he is Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University, and is author of a new book that explores this territory, A Very Brief History of Eternity. It's published by the Princeton University Press. Several callers here. We'll get next to Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning, Professor. My name is Tom. I'm sort of fascinated with history. We talk about eternity. Where does the concept come from? If, you know, most people think it's a religious thought, and I think the word of ontology and philosophy, whether things exist or not, and that can, I suppose, could be related out to it's got to begin somewhere, or it doesn't begin. But I wanted to say that you generally, if you're looking at eternity, you got one of two worldviews. You have the worldview of what we call an evolutionist worldview, where everything started out with randomness, let's say pond scum, and is over billions and billions of years, it's getting better and better and better and better, and we're ascending higher and higher. Or there's a worldview of the creationist, which comes from the Tanakh or the Bible, the Holy Scriptures, where God created everything very good or perfect, and when Adam sinned, then God cursed the cosmos or the universe, and it's been going downhill until there'll be a day of redemption. And the Bible does have something about what we call uniformity. Now, my father was a microbiologist scientist, and so uniformity is very important for a scientist. The scriptures in Genesis 8:22 basically says, "While the earth remaineth, seed time and harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night shall not cease." Well, here God is telling Noah that everything is going to continue as they have been. It's going to be repeatable. It's uniformity. And if you're a scientist, you're looking at setting up an experiment. You have had past history, and you set an experiment up, change variables, and you expect continuous results. Now, with the evolutionist worldview, you cannot use that principle. You can't find. You cannot use it anywhere whatsoever.
I've got to get you. Give our guest a chance to make some kind of response.
Okay, go ahead.
Have you got a thought about that?
Yeah, well, certainly. Discussion of eternity is part and parcel of philosophy, and as the caller mentioned, yes, you know, ontology, the very idea that became the Christian notion of eternity comes from Greek philosophy, from Greek ontology. We're back to the question of, you know, order, design, structure, continuity, the repeatability of criteria in scientific experiments pointing towards some order. What the Bible, especially the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures, doesn't have very clearly expressed is this concept of eternity as something outside of time, save for a few passages here and there, and especially one of the most important one in the Psalms, the one that says that to God, to Yahweh, one day is as 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as one day, which Christian theologians took as the central revelation of the fact that God, who is eternal, is outside of time. And as the medieval theologians and philosophers developed this concept, they came up with the idea that God lives in an eternal now, whereas we live in a sequential series of nows, in which time itself has an unreality to it. This was Augustine's take on it in the 5th century. Augustine was examining time itself and said, we know time has an illusory quality to it because it's not a fixed point ever. If you say the word now, or in Latin nunc, by the time you get to the last letter of saying it, it's already behind you. So the present doesn't really exist. Which is a way of sort of heightening the reality of eternity vis-a-vis time.
We have to go on. I want to thank the caller. We, again, have about 10 minutes left. We'll go to next Belgium, line four. Hello.
Yes, hello. Great show. When you were talking about heaven and hell, I thought of a quote by I forget who. But the quote is, hell is other people.
Okay.
I just thought that was funny.
Is that something you're familiar with, Professor Aaron?
I think I lost the communication there for a few seconds. I didn't quite get a complete sentence.
Hell, I think with the call, say it again, caller, that hell
is other people.
Hell is of the people.
It's other people.
Oh,
other
hell
people,
is
yes.
Other people.
Yeah, that's Jean-Paul Sartre. I believe that's Jean-Paul Sartre, right? Yeah.
Okay, yeah, I guess so.
Hell
yeah.
Is other people.
Other
I
people.
See. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's also, he didn't come up with that out of thin air. It was an old, already ancient concept before he gave it that peculiar expression.
All right.
It's part and parcel of thinking of eternity as some extension of the here and now, right? If it's just an extension, yes, then, you know, would you want to spend eternity with the people you dislike the most? That's a hell, certainly. Would you like to spend eternity with people you're indifferent to? Well, that's a purgatory. Would you like to spend eternity with people that you really love and admire and who love you back? Well, you know, that's heaven. Hmm. And actually, that's the Christian view of eternal life in heaven is, you know, eternal bliss because it's eternal love. You're in the presence of God, who is love eternal. And that's what the beatific vision is all about, as described by Christian mystics, especially through in the medieval period, that the beatific vision is more than a vision. It's a total participation in the being of God, who is pure love. It doesn't get any better than that. Angels with harps on clouds. I love the New Yorker cartoons. New Yorker for decades has had cartoons that are in heaven, right? And it's always people on clouds with harps and so on.
And wings.
Some of them terribly funny. And wings, yes, that's true.
All right, let's go to another Belgium caller here, line two. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I don't know if you touched this, but maybe you have. In the last couple of comments, you've kind of pinned to it to a little bit. It seems to me that all of everything that we deal with, we always put human aspirations on it. We think dogs have personalities, cats have personalities, trees, everything. Even our deities we make humanistic. So isn't really eternity and heaven and everything we're discussing just really a human condition? Animals don't really think too much about eternity or hell, or at least not that we know about. So isn't this really what you're talking about, a human condition and nothing more?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That is the subject, how humans have conceived of eternity for themselves. You see, my book is not about eternity as an abstract philosophical concept. My book is about eternity as conceived by humans, and not just humans abstractly, but by individuals and societies. That's what I think is the best any historian can do with eternity in trying to trace the history of the concept. It's always an embodied concept, embodied in humans and in human thought. You can't go beyond that as a historian, even a historian of religion. Once you get past that point, you're philosophizing or theologizing. And it's totally anthropomorphic or human-centered, absolutely. To the point, I mean, talk about pets. This Pew poll also revealed that a very high percentage of Americans, over 40%, I forget the exact figure, believe that their pets will have eternal life too. Here's the way in which, you know, beliefs don't always sort of fit together, because the Pew poll also revealed that only 2% of Americans are vegetarians. So, you know, a lot of what, you know, these people who believe that pets also have eternal life, I guess they don't give it any thought. But if they gave it some thought, they'd realize that they're eating an eternal creature, unless they make some distinction between pets and chickens. poor kid working for 4-H, you know, grooming the animal for the state or county fair, you know, eventually gets sold to a butcher. God knows what would happen.
We have a few minutes left. One thing I really – we have about 5 minutes here. We're 5 minutes. And one thing I really want to talk about, because I think it goes to this question of how it is we think about eternity and what that means for society. You write that in the Middle Ages for the Christian church, eternity was actually a money-making proposition. They made much of the fact that they were the gatekeepers of eternity and that worked for them for a while. However, that also was one of the things that energized Luther and the people who were responsible for the Reformation. So, in fact, eternity helped to overturn the existing order within the Western Church.
Very much so. It's one of the pivotal turning points in Western history, the rejection of a very solid connection between this world and the other, between the church and eternity. It's what Luther rejected, and Ulrich Zwingli and John Calvin and every other major Protestant reformer rejected, was the idea that there was a connection between the living and the dead. The dead were dead. There's nothing you could do for them. And there was nothing the dead could do for you, because, you know, part of the medieval Christian Catholic notion of eternity, which is still part of the Roman Catholic tradition, is that the dead and the living are linked through the church and its rituals. And the dead in heaven, the saints, can help you out. They can pray for you. And you can pray for the dead who might be still being cleansed of their sins in purgatory. The Protestant Reformation throws all of this out the window, and in my book I argue that this is an important step towards the secularization of the world.
Back now here where we're coming to the end, maybe we can come back to one of those points that we began with, that is the idea that there are a lot of people who say, as individuals, they personally believe in this idea of eternity and it's attached to their religious belief, but that as a society, it is something that we don't believe in anymore. Maybe we could again come back to that question. Well, what, not only why is that the case, but what does that mean? Is there some significance to the fact that perhaps as a society, at least, it's not something that we believe in, we talk about, it's not part of our everyday discourse, this idea of eternity.
Right. And how does it affect our behavior?
That
for me was the key question, you know, what difference does it make that eternity is no longer a sort of publicly, commonly shared concept? And there are pluses and there are minuses. You know, on the big minus scale, I think that all the totalitarian regimes that we saw spring up in the 20th century, some of which are still in place, total materialism leads to things like the Third Reich and Stalin's Soviet Union, Mao's China, Cambodia, Pol Pot. These are places where the horizon was shrunk to the immediate moment. And with that shrinking, the individual also disappeared. The individual becomes like a grain of sand on the beach or an ant in an ant colony. That's a real negative thing. On the positive side, though, look at what we're facing now with terrorists, jihadists, who are willing to blow themselves up and everyone around them because they think that this is going to earn them a place in an eternal paradise. People who don't believe in eternity tend not to fly planes into crowded buildings. That's one of the things that we're shocked. We in the West cannot understand how anyone could do that. Well, it's quite obvious. It's staring us in the face. This is the difference belief makes. Belief is a real thing. It motivates people. Back again on the plus side of, you know, what difference believing in eternity makes in the West, this is undeniable, you know, and this is what Voltaire worried about. What if we do away with eternity? How do we get people to behave? The idea of a linkage between behavior in the here and now and an eternal existence beyond the here and now is what has shaped Western ethics. Should the belief in eternity vanish altogether? It's already vanished from the public sphere. Should it vanish from the private sphere? I don't want to be around. I really don't. not in the here and now, because I think it's going to be a definite slide down a very steep and very deep cliff.
Well, there at that, we will finish. Would you like to read more of our guest thinking on the subject? The book to look for is A Very Brief History of Eternity. It's published by the Princeton University Press by our guest, Carlos Ayer. He is Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University. Professor Ayer, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on the show. And having lived up the road in Bloomington, Illinois, it was so wonderful to hear these place names being called out. It was a trip back for me.
Always glad to welcome prodigal sons back. Thank you very much.
Thank you.